You're with us for the morning show as we have presidential candidate conversations leading up to the November election 2 weeks from today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So today we're hearing from the Biden ticket with a surrogate who is actively campaigning on his behalf. We have U.S. Representative from Delaware, Lisa Blunt Rochester, who serves as national co-chair of former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign. What do you want to ask her about stances on policy, about the campaign trail? We're at 800-642-1234. Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate, and thank you to the listeners for having me.
Well, COVID here in Wisconsin is absolutely raging. It's surging. How would Biden get the U.S. back on track? How do you stop the spread without causing our main streets here in Wisconsin to go dark?
You know, well, first of all, we want to acknowledge that there are so many people right now suffering and hurting because of this pandemic. We have, as we know, 8 million cases in the United States, 220,000 individuals who have passed. And the challenge that we have is that the current president doesn't really have a plan. And so we can tell you that, first of all, Joe Biden would start off with the plan that he laid out in March, which starts with listening to the experts and following the science and calling on Americans to wear a mask in public. It's not a political statement. I mean, the top scientists say that 100,000 lives would be saved in the next 100 days alone. And so, number one, we would make sure that there is free testing, treatment, and make sure that there are going to be vaccines that are available for everyone and distributed in a fair way. Also, you don't get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which protects people from pre-existing conditions, which Donald Trump is trying to do at the Supreme Court, in a time of a global pandemic. It just doesn't make sense. And then also just using the Defense Production Act in an effective way to make sure that we have masks and that we have the protective gear for our healthcare workers, those on job sites and in schools. I mean, it's just really making sure that we have a plan and we address it, and we address it in a safe and fair way. That's something that's lacking right now with this president. And I think that's why people are voting in record numbers.
You mentioned vaccines. How hands-on would the Biden administration be in deciding who is first in line for a vaccine? And would Americans be required to get vaccinated?
Well, first of all, Vice President Joe Biden has been very clear that, as I mentioned before, we have to follow the science and we have to make sure that the vaccines are safe and effective. You would, of course, have to be very specific and targeted as well in how these vaccines are distributed. That begins with looking at your healthcare experts and those who are on the front lines and that will need to have it to make sure that we can continue to deal with the pandemic. And then you would look at, you know, communities that are hardest hit and most impacted. Right now, we have seen just a disproportionate number of individuals, people of color, that are dying from this pandemic. And so, again, it would be a real plan that is focused and that really relies on the experts, the medical experts and the scientists to help us with that plan. But right now, unfortunately, we have a president that it's not clear. It's sort of like every state for himself or herself. And what we need is a national effort to combat this pandemic, because we know it really affects not only people's lives, but their livelihoods and their ability for their businesses or their farms or their children to even go back to school. It affects all of us.
We're talking with U.S. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester, national co-chair of the Biden campaign, as part of our candidate conversations leading up to the November election. What issues are most important to you as you consider who you'll vote for? Do you know who you'll be voting for? How did you come to your decision? We're at 800-642-1234. Congresswoman, you know, I want to take a look here at consensus building. Why are the stimulus negotiations going poorly, and what would go differently if Biden were in office to get Congress to work together?
You know, what an important question, Kate. I mean, first of all, I want Wisconsins to remember that we were able on a bipartisan level to pass the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Families First Act. And it really was understanding that, you know, we're in this together and that the danger of doing little was greater than the danger of doing too much. I mean, even Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, has said that this is an important time for us to really, really invest. It's unfortunate that on the Senate side, I mean, this is part of a larger pattern of them not governing and Mitch McConnell not governing. We've sent over 300 bipartisan bills to the Senate, and they have not acted on them. And I think right now what you would see from a President Biden is a person who can bring people together. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm from Delaware. He's been my senator and my vice president and my friend for 30 years. And I've seen him work across the aisle, Democrats, Republicans, independents, bringing them together. And it's a matter of leadership. This president hasn't met with Speaker Pelosi in a year. I think that fortunately she has had a good working relationship with Mr. Mnuchin, and we are hopeful that today we will see the fruits of that labor. But I really think it goes back to the leadership and the intention and the real focus on being a president for all the people, not just some of the people.
I want to look at where progressives are in this picture, because Biden is sending some mixed messages on the Green New Deal. How do you respond to progressives who feel that they're voting for Biden basically because he maybe not be as bad as Trump? Where does he stand on the Green New Deal?
Well, I think, you know, Joe Biden has been really, really clear that, number one, the Green New Deal provided the framework for our conversations and for us as a Democratic Party to come together under a unity platform. That unity platform had the range from blue dogs to progressives sitting at the table to come out with a plan of action. And Joe has been the most progressive, starting on issues like climate change before it was popular, before people talked about it. And so as a person who is in Congress, and I'm in both the New Dem caucus as well as the Progressive caucus, I can tell you what we've been able to do as Democrats is marry the fact that we can do well for our economy and do good for our planet by creating the plan that we have to build back better. If you just look at the plan, you will see there is a focus on a green economy. There is an intersection between health and wellness. And there is, again, a focus on building back better. So we're not going to be distracted by those that are trying to tear us apart. I think that's kind of par for the course for the current administration, to divide and try to conquer. But we're going to be united. And that's what Joe Biden can do. He's the person who can bring people together from Harlem to the heartland.
We're talking with U.S. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware. She's national co-chair of the Biden campaign as we have these presidential candidate conversations leading up to the election 2 weeks away. And she was on the committee that led the search for and vetted Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris. What issues are most important to you as you consider who you'll vote for? Did you vote early? How did you make your decision? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware, right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're having candidate conversations leading up to the November election. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And today we're hearing from a Biden surrogate as Democrats take to the campaign trail to rally voters. U.S. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware co-chairs Biden's national campaign. What do you want to know about Biden's policies, his campaign events 2 weeks ahead of Election Day? Are you an undecided voter? What questions do you have about Biden's stance on particular issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester stays with us for 10 more minutes. So President Trump has held large rallies in Wisconsin, held a rally in Janesville over the weekend. How is Biden campaigning in Wisconsin? We're the swingiest of swing states, as the New York Times tells us.
Well, you know, first of all, Wisconsin is, as you all know, a very, very important state for this election. And I think how the two candidates are campaigning is a testament to how they handle and would handle this current pandemic and crisis. You have one candidate, Joe Biden, who is being very responsible, making sure that we are getting out to the voters in Wisconsin by being on the ground, but also virtually and doing it in a safe way. And then you have the current president who is creating these super spreader events. And I think it is irresponsible, and it also doesn't show that he knows how or have a plan to get this virus under control. So needless to say, we are very much focused on making sure that folks from Wisconsin are safe, but also get Joe Biden's message. And I think it's really important that folks know this is an important day today. I mean, today, early in-person voting starts in Wisconsin, and you can register in so many different ways. We want to make sure that people know that they can do same day at the polling location, but they have to make sure they bring an ID and proof of residence. And if you don't know for sure what to do, go to iwillvote.com/WI for more information. It's really important that people know this. And again, we're trying to campaign. We're not taking anything for granted. We know that, you know, we started on day one, making sure that we focused on great infrastructure right there on the ground with a great team of folks. But it's clear we have to be safe and do it in a way that protects people and allows them to understand and hear Joe Biden's message.
Let's take a call now. Chris is joining us from Hillsborough this morning. Hi, Chris. What's your question?
Hi. I actually have two questions. And I'll say them, and then I have to go because I have to go teach. But I'm a special education teacher, and it has been really difficult on teachers and students with the pandemic and meeting their needs, keeping them, you know, distant, trying to meet all our virtual kids because, you know, they have all these choices. Is there going to be – what is the plan for education to put some of this burden off from teachers? I mean, I work until 7:30, 8 o'clock every night because I have so many diversity kids at different levels to meet their needs and then to get the ones online. My second question is about a stimulus check. I know that when they did the unemployment and gave the extra $600, well, I lost the after-school program I ran. I did sports because I'm a single mom of four. I didn't get any extra money, and I had to go find another job, and I found two and to pay my bills. But then I had all these people on unemployment who were getting this extra $600, and some of my friends were refusing to go back to work because they were making more on unemployment. But there was no help out there for the ones of us that we kept our jobs but had to work and do extra to pay our bills.
Yeah, Chris, thank you for bringing that to the table. Representative, tackling Chris's questions one at a time. Go ahead.
Yes. First of all, Chris, thank you so much for your question and for the work that you do as an educator. We just had a roundtable with teachers even here in my state, and I heard from them similar, just the challenges of, number one, going back to work confidently for those that are going in person. Number two, the challenges of even access to broadband and internet and connectivity issues, as well as an educator trying to balance your own family with educating students from other families. First of all, part of the reason why Joe Biden is so focused on dealing with this pandemic is that until we get a handle on this pandemic, people can't confidently and safely and return to their workplaces or their schools. without going back and forth, between openings and closings. And so it's really important that, number one, we get a handle on that. And that's everything from making sure that schools have the supports that they need, whether it's disinfectant, whether it's PPE, whether it's new tools and technology. Secondly, as it pertains to education in general, if you go to joebiden.com, you will see a plan for education that also deals with, you mentioned, whether it's children that, are coming from challenging environments or neighborhoods, or that just don't have the resources, or that have special needs. He talks about an investment in Title I and other programs that will help to support you as an educator and help support those families. As it pertains to the economy and stimulus checks, one of the things that we've seen, and as I mentioned, I'm a member of Congress, so I got a chance to vote on those stimulus checks as well as supports for families. The bottom line is that during that time, we knew we had to be bold in our approach to dealing with this pandemic, both because of our fiscal health as well as our physical health. And those investments did help millions of families from falling off a cliff. Unfortunately, and actually had improved our poverty rate in this country. Unfortunately, because many of those things have expired, it is now causing families to have to not have food to put on the table. Never in our lives have we seen in my lifetime, and I'm 58, seen so many Americans in food lines wondering where they're going, whether they're going to be able to pay their mortgage or their rent. This is a time that we have to invest and have a bold, comprehensive plan, and we have to do it in a united way. And so I would encourage you, if you were entitled to something and didn't get it, that you please also reach out to your congressional office. I know in my state, we've helped many people who didn't receive their check or had a problem with Social Security or the IRS. That's what we're here for. So please reach out to us.
Let's bring in Ron now in Madison with a question. Hi, Ron. Ron, can you hear us? Oh, I don't think we can hear Ron. On the issue of taxes, what is Biden's plan for extending tax cuts for the middle class or raising taxes on Americans?
First of all, Joe Biden has been really, really clear that when we look at the current administration and the current president, the focus has been really cutting taxes for the wealthiest and for corporations. And Joe Biden feels that we need to be investing in working class people and those individuals that need the support more than those that really don't. And so the plan, as he has stated, is that if you make over $400,000, your taxes will go up. If you make under $400,000, they won't. This is a plan that will have to be worked through with Congress. And I think, again, one of the things that has been a challenge to the current administration is working with Congress. But with Joe Biden, he will work hand in glove with us to make sure that we have the funds for the investments that we need to make sure that we deal with this pandemic, as well as rebound our economy. And he will also make sure that those individuals who should be paying their fair share are paying their fair share.
We're talking with Biden surrogate U.S. Representative Lisa Blunt, Rochester of Delaware, our guide to this installment of Presidential Ticket Conversations. Congresswoman, Biden was the lead author of the 1994 crime bill. He apologized for effects of that legislation that jailed people of color for nonviolent crimes. What will he do to reform the criminal justice system, and what policies would address systemic racism in our country?
I think, again, this is a perfect contrast for the voters of Wisconsin to look at the records of Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Going all the way back to the beginning years when Joe Biden was advocating and fighting for civil rights, as well as dealing with issues such as redlining, compared to Donald Trump, whose family was facing, challenges and court challenges because of discriminating against people of color in housing, as one example. then you look currently at some of the policies that Donald Trump has put forward, everything from in a time when we are dealing with a racial reckoning, creating an executive order to tell you know, agencies and companies, if you are doing things that increase diversity and inclusion and are dealing with this kind of training, that will take your funding away. Whereas Joe Biden has said he and Kamala Harris have a real plan, starting with the recognition that racism is real and is institutional and structural, and that we have to deal with it in our criminal justice system, as well as other parts of our agencies. And so you will see from the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, where we talk about accountability, because as Kamala Harris said, bad cops are bad for good cops. Joe Biden believes that we need to make sure that we address our criminal justice system in a way that acknowledges our history, but also creates accountability, transparency, and training to improve our criminal justice system.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was U.S. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network.
Live.
We're talking about what's called the We're All In Small Business Grants through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Businesses are getting access to the CARES Act stimulus through a second round of grant funding. Are you a small business owner? Have you applied for or received a grant? What is it doing for you and your business? We're at 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Public Radio's Rachel Vasquez has been reporting on the We're All In grants. Rachel, welcome back.
Hey, Kate.
So you've been talking with small businesses and learning how they're standing up here in the pandemic. What have you heard out there?
I think that a lot of them are really struggling. I think it kind of depends on which businesses you're talking about. But in general, I think small businesses are having a really hard time right now. You know, I started reporting on what small businesses are going through in the summer. And, you know, early on, I remember talking to an owner of a cafe in Madison who told me that if he gets a second round of federal aid, and only if, he thought that he had a 50-50 shot of surviving. Mm. So I think that that is kind of illustrative of some of the urgency and desperation that a lot of small businesses are feeling, in particular restaurants and bars. They are some that are having the hardest time right now.
Well, and certainly with capacity as well, we're going back now to the no more than 25% of a building's occupancy until November 6th with Governor Evers' limit on a size of indoor gatherings reinstated by a judge. How do businesses feel about this capacity limitation?
I think it, again, depends on the kinds of businesses that you're talking about. I think mm-hmm. that I spoke initially about to retailers, to small retailers, to see how this order would affect them. And I heard from a lot of them that they didn't think it would affect them that much. I talked to the owner of a small women's consignment store in Superior, and she told me that she didn't think it would affect her business that much. It's her business doesn't really operate, doesn't really need tons of customers packed into her store to make her business profitable. But when I talked to, again, restaurant and bar owners, it was a really different tone. I spoke to the owner of a steakhouse in Milwaukee, Carnivore, and he told me in very dire terms that the order would have been, the capacity limits would have been the nail in the coffin for a lot of restaurants. So it definitely depends what kind of business. But again, for restaurants and bars,
they run on volume.
Exactly. They are kind of premised on the idea of being busy at specific times. And that has changed, obviously, during the pandemic. And so these capacity limits for them would have been you know, bad news for them.
Yeah, you can no longer have a lunch rush or a dinner rush, or, you know, those rushes just can't be. So let's look at these grants, though. We're All In grants. They're providing $5,000 to about 10,000 small businesses across the state. Who is eligible for these grants?
So the Governor Evers announced money for these grants, about $50 million, about 2 weeks ago. And this is the second round of We're All In grants, and they are really targeted towards the businesses that have been the hardest hit by the pandemic. They're looking specifically for businesses that have been injured by the pandemic. So businesses that were open and running in 2019, businesses that were still running in 2020 and have suffered some kind of economic damage from the pandemic. And they're targeting businesses like hair salons, barber shops, restaurants, bars, nail salons, the ones that have seen kind of the greatest hit so far. And they're specifically also giving priority to businesses with ethnically diverse ownership. I think kind of based on the understanding that those are also some of the businesses that may have fallen through the cracks of bigger federal aid programs.
But it seems like $5,000 is just a drop in the bucket. What are businesses doing with $5,000?
I think that's true for some businesses. I spoke to that one business owner in particular who had such dire warnings about the capacity restrictions. And he told me, the owner of that steakhouse in Milwaukee, he told me that $5,000 barely keeps the lights on for him for 1 month. And he is a bigger restaurant. But I think that kind of helps you understand that for some businesses, this really doesn't go that far for them. I spoke to other businesses, though, who said that this $5,000 will be very impactful for them. In particular, I think business owners really like the We're All In grants specifically because there aren't a lot of strings attached. For bigger federal aid programs like the Paycheck Protection Program that a lot of small businesses use, there were a lot of kind of rules and stipulations for how they spent that money. And the We're All In grants are much more, they're kind of wide open. They let you use the money for a lot of different things, for covering things like payroll, buying PPE for your staff, covering rent. So I think businesses like the We're All In grants for that reason, even if for some they don't, the money doesn't go that far.
They have a lot more latitude in what they can use that money for. We're talking with Rachel Vasquez. She's a reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio. She's been covering what small businesses are going through in this pandemic. We're specifically looking at the We're All In grants. Another round, phase two, has opened. You can join in with your questions. Are you a small business owner? How have you been doing in the pandemic? Have you been able to stay open? What do you think about capacity limits now, if you're a bar or a restaurant? Is your business driven on capacity? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. So Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Secretary Missy Hughes says this program won't help all businesses struggling right now. What does she mean by this?
Yeah, when I talked to her, the way that I took those comments, the way that I understood those comments was that basically state government has limited resources to deal with this pandemic and the kind of economic fallout of it. And they have to make choices about, you know, what kinds of businesses they help. And I think that by definition means that some businesses won't be helped that much by this grant program, specifically bigger businesses like the one that I mentioned who said that this $5,000 won't go that far for him. But they, like I said, are targeting really, really small businesses, businesses that might have fallen through the cracks, who might not have been helped by other aid programs. And in doing that, I think they decided that there are some businesses that, you know, they're trying to target this money at the businesses who didn't get help from other programs. And that means that the program won't be as effective for all other kinds of businesses.
Can you give us a sense of what is a micro business?
Yeah, I don't know kind of the specifics around what she meant by that. I think she means she was talking specifically about businesses who are really, really small, the kind of mom and pop businesses that you probably know and love and patronize, that don't have maybe pre-existing relationships with banks. When the Paycheck Protection Program was created by the federal government, it was administered through banks. And what we found from the reporting was that a lot of businesses, really small businesses, businesses with owners of color who didn't have existing relationships with banks, they didn't get a lot of help from that program because they didn't have those relationships. And so she was talking specifically about those kinds of businesses, hoping that this program would help them.
Looking more broadly at what relief is coming from the federal government, Democrats and Republicans still at a stalemate over the next federal stimulus package. How might that affect potential relief funding for small businesses? What are you watching for there?
Well, I think that there are a lot of small businesses that are watching those talks kind of nervously with bated breath. I think that it's also true that there a lot of the small business owners that I talk to have a lot of pessimism around whether they will actually reach a deal on aid. I gave you the example of the small business owner in Madison who I talked to months ago, who said that he desperately needed this money from the federal government. That kind of urgency has not gone away when I talk to restaurant and bar owners. So I think that, I mean, when I talked to Missy Hughes, she was actually pretty optimistic about the possibility of a federal stimulus plan coming together before the end of the year. When I talk to small business owners, they're definitely less optimistic than she was, but they're really counting on it.
Rachel, are you circling back to these businesses you talked with much earlier in the pandemic to kind of see how they are through the phases?
Yeah, I've talked to a number of them multiple times. Like I mentioned initially, the small women's consignment store in Superior. I spoke to the owner of that store back in March and then again a few weeks ago, and she was one of the ones who was doing okay, who said that she actually said that there are some days for her that she's busier now than she was before the pandemic. But again, for restaurants and bars, it's a completely different story. They are kind of months into not having aid from the federal government and kind of facing the prospect of the colder months coming when they lose outdoor dining. And so they, I think, are in a very different boat and struggling a lot.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Rachel Vasquez is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter. Coming up, we talk with President Trump's former National Security Advisor, Ambassador John Bolton, joins us to look at U.S. foreign policy and whether we're better off today. Talk with Ambassador Bolton, who wrote the book about his time in the White House. That's right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with Ambassador John Bolton about threats to the U.S. He sums it up as China and Russia. He was National Security Advisor to the Trump administration from 2018 to 2019. And his memoir earlier this year called the president erratic and, quote, stunningly uninformed, pursuing policy driven by a desire for reelection. Your questions for Ambassador Bolton, 800-642-1234. Tomorrow night, Bolton will headline an online event at the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Ambassador Bolton, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be with you.
Well, starting with the coronavirus pandemic, considering the coronavirus originated in China and a trade deal was in the works with Beijing, did our relationship with China deter the president from putting aggressive measures in place to stop the spread of the virus when he knew it was airborne and deadlier than the flu?
Yeah, I think there are many reasons for the failure of the president's policies, not least of which is he has never seemed to think in strategic terms, plotting out long-term policy objectives and so on. But in the case of the coronavirus in particular, when word began to get to the United States, to the Centers for Disease Control and National Security Council and National Institutes of Health in very early January of this year, the president simply didn't want to hear bad things about Xi Jinping, bad things about what might be happening medically in China, what bad things might be happening to the Chinese economy, or anything that would interfere with what we now understand to be a kind of interim trade deal that was signed between China and the United States in January of this year, and mostly because the president didn't want to hear about potential bad news for the U.S. economy, which he saw as his ticket to reelection. So I won't go through them all here, but many news media have accumulated a list of statements by the president, cabinet members, senior advisors, January, February, March, April, all saying it's nothing, it's going to go away, it's going to magically disappear, we've got it under control, so on and so forth, which was a form of denial that fit into the president's long-term election prospects. And, you know, I think you've seen in the twists and turns in what the president has said about the coronavirus, what the administration has done, that lack of strategy, that lack of willingness to confront it and try and deal with it systematically.
The National Security Council's Pandemic Response Unit was dissolved, I believe, a month after you became National Security Advisor in 2018. Should that unit that's focused on global health and security and biodefense, should it be restored under the NSC?
Absolutely not. This really is a kind of bureaucratic myth. I mean, you'd have to be a bureaucrat to think that the boxes and lines of the NSC staff would have made a difference, particularly with Donald Trump in place. And what I did was, in trying to streamline the NSC staff, I put the office that dealt with pandemics together with the office that dealt with biological warfare. Because the epidemiology of a pandemic and the epidemiology of a biological weapons attack are often very similar. I think it strengthened our capacity to respond. And in fact, if you look at the New York Times massive report in April of this year, it says quite accurately that in early January, and of course this is 3 months after I've left the White House, I'm not claiming any credit for myself here, I'm claiming credit for the staff of the NSC. Early January, NSC staff raised red flags about this. If you've read Bob Woodward's book, Rage, he talks about how my successor and the deputy national security advisor, Matt Pottinger, went to Trump in late January and said, this is the most pressing national security crisis of your presidency. The problem had nothing to do with where people were assigned within the NSC staff. The problem was the empty chair behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office.
Talking with John Bolton, President Trump's former national security advisor. He's also an ambassador to the United Nations under George W. Bush. Taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom in Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Ambassador, when we pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, I wish you'd explain that a little bit, and then explain how that ties in with this policy of the preemptive strike policy we have or don't have. We'll strike first, or if we think someone's going to strike us.
Well, the Iran nuclear deal was a very, very bad deal. It was not based on any understanding that Iran itself had made a strategic decision to give up nuclear weapons. In fact, all the evidence we have is that Iran intended the exact opposite and that it continued developing centrifuge capabilities to be capable of enriching uranium at even more rapid rates that they already had. They've continued and had success with their ballistic missile program. And the benefits that Iran got from the return of tens of billions of dollars of frozen assets and relief from international sanctions allowed the Ayatollahs to consolidate their rule inside Iran and to spread terrorism and conventional military activity across the Middle East. So all across the board, this was a very bad deal for the United States, for the West, for our friends in the Middle East. And it's only permitted Iran to continue to pursue these objectives of deliverable nuclear weapons, enhanced terrorist activity, and malign conventional warfare in the Middle East as a whole. I'm not sure the exact relationship of your question on preemptive, the preemptive doctrine, but this was something that we talked about in the Bush 43 administration, and I can summarize it sort of like this. If you think that a country is developing, let's say, nuclear weapons with an intention to use them against the United States or its friends, in this case, let's take Israel in the Middle East, I don't believe the United States is required to wait until Milwaukee has been destroyed by a nuclear weapon before it acts to defend itself. And it's only in very, very rare circumstances that you would use preemptive military force, but you would use it when the civilian population of the United States or friends and allies like Israel, Britain, Japan, Australia, around the world might come under threat.
Ambassador, staying in that part of the world, the U.S. will pull thousands of troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan by next month. President Trump is trying to make good on a campaign promise to get out of our endless wars. Is this troop withdrawal the right move?
No, I think they're both bad mistakes. I mean, look, we may not like being in these countries, but the fact is we remain under terrorist threat around the world. In many places, it's getting far worse. Certainly, it's spreading across Africa. It could come to this country very quickly. And the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think, is going to lead to a return to power of the Taliban very quickly. And I fear very much that, again, Afghanistan will become a haven for international terrorism. You know, it is a mistake when the national leadership of our country doesn't explain to people that we are safer when we are deployed in forward positions like that to deal with threats before they threaten us here at home. The United States is a country with global interest and global friends and global adversaries. That's the nature of the success that our country's had economically and politically. But we keep our civilian population safer when we have these foreign deployments, and to withdraw them, I think, is going to put us at greater risk.
Is it possible to withdraw all 5,000 troops and dismantle the U.S. military headquarters in Afghanistan by the end of the year? Is that plausible?
I think that would be unrealistic, but this is Trump in political rhetoric mode. He's got 2 weeks left until the election. He's obviously very worried about his prospects. So, you know, he'll promise to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. He'll promise you checks for $1,200. He'll promise you vaccines. He'll promise almost anything at this stage.
Should the U.S. proceed with the process of withdrawing from the World Health Organization?
Well, I think that the World Health Organization could stand a substantial amount of reform, and I think one way that the United States has made its weight felt in the United Nations system before was by withdrawing from organizations or cutting off their funding. This was something, for example, that George H.W. Bush threatened in 1989, threatened the World Health Organization when its membership was considering making the Palestine Liberation Organization a member. George H.W. Bush, Jim Baker said at the time, if you do that, we will cut off all funding to the WHO, and that stopped it cold. So I think China's influence in the WHO, sadly, made WHO complicit in the Chinese cover-up of what happened with the coronavirus in its early days, to our great detriment.
Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Bolton is a former national security advisor to President Trump. He was also an ambassador to the United Nations. Tomorrow evening, he'll speak with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. We have a link to that event at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.